Crews searching the waters off the coast of Brazil today found more debris from the crash of Air France Flight 447. The Airbus jet carried 228 people when it disappeared Monday on its way from Rio de Janeiro to Paris. Investigators know the plane encountered violent storms and that automated systems reported electrical problems, but exactly what happened and why remain mysteries. The black box recorders that could provide answers are believed to lie somewhere amid a rugged range of underwater mountains as much as 2 miles below the surface. Recovery, experts say, will be a tremendous challenge, and the families of passengers of Flight 447 may never know what happened to their loved ones. Does this accident affect your decision to fly? Would that change if you knew why it had happened? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now is John Hansman, Jr., who directs the International Center for Air Transportation at MIT. He's an expert in air transportation and safety. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
And at this point, do you think we're ever likely to find out what happened to this flight?
Yeah, I think we're going to figure it out. Even if we don't recover the black boxes, I think there will be significant clues in those detailed maintenance records that were sent back. So I think we'll be able to piece together at least reasonable hypotheses of what happened.
The detailed maintenance records, you mean the electrical alerts?
Yeah, this airplane was equipped with ACARS, a reporting system, which basically automatically sent maintenance reports of problems on board the airplane. So once we get, I haven't seen the details of those, but there were apparently 10 messages. I think by looking at those in detail, we'll be able to figure out which systems on the airplane were failing and in what order. That information will be useful in at least putting together hypotheses as to what could have been happening.
And will more information be gleaned if some of that debris can be recovered?
Absolutely. The debris will give significant information. So, for example, if any of the debris is burned, you would know that there was a fire. By the location of the debris, it will give you some insight as to whether the airplane was together when it hit. Unfortunately, nobody got there for a couple of days, so it had spread out. So it's not as useful as if we'd gotten there right away.
And the black boxes, 2 miles beneath the surface and apparently extremely rugged terrain, they only beam their beacons for about 30 days. That's going to be hard.
Yeah, this is going to be a very tough recovery in the black boxes. As you noted, the black boxes give off sonar pings for about 30 days. So if they can get recovery vehicles to the area quickly enough and can locate the black boxes, there is a chance that they can recover them. If they don't do it, it's going to be a very hard search in the bottom of that deep ocean.
There's a few things that I think people just have a hard time understanding about this particular incident. One of which, yes, violent storms, but modern aircraft fly into thunderstorms all the time.
Sure. We normally don't fly into thunderstorms. We normally fly around them. Modern aircraft are equipped with weather radar, which we use to pick our way even when there's areas of severe storms. And even if you do go into a storm, the airplanes are designed to be strong enough to take the turbulence loads. They are metallized, so there shouldn't be a problem with lightning. If you are hit by hail, for example, that can be a problem. It can cause some damage to the airplane. But the airplane should stay airworthy and should be able to fly. So it may be that the storms are related to what happened, but the storms in and of themselves should not have caused the airplane to come down.
Another thing people find hard to understand, why couldn't the pilots, there was no time to radio a mayday?
When you're out over the ocean, when you're offshore, you can't use the same radio that you use when you're over land masses. So over land masses, we use what we call VHF radio, which is line of sight. When you're in that situation, you can just pick up the radio and call quickly. Over the oceans, you use what we call high-frequency radio. It's short-wave radio. And it's literally like going back to the 1940s where you have to tune the radio, you're basically bouncing the signals off the ionosphere. As a result, pilots don't normally listen to the radio full-time. They only use it for their check-ins every 600 miles or so. So if you were having a problem, in order to get on the high-frequency radio, get the right frequency, it would take 3 or 4 minutes worth of work. And presumably the crew was busy at that time, and from their own priority, it was probably more important to try and fly the airplane than to try to communicate.
And another is that, though if you start thinking about the distances involved, this quickly resolves, but that the plane, you know, initial reports were it vanished from radar. Well, of course, it wasn't on radar.
Yeah, it didn't vanish from radar. It went off the edge of the radar coverage area, which it normally would do when it went out to sea. And then from what we can tell, it went through this area of storms. They were scheduled to check in about 10 or 15 minutes after those automatic reports were sent in. I should note that the reason why those maintenance reports were able to come in is they come in as basically data messages that are sent through a satellite. It is possible, and I don't know if this airplane was equipped with it, to send data messages to land through a satellite link. But that would be like sending a text message. And again, if the crew was busy, they probably weren't doing that.
And part of the problem is if we don't figure out what happened, if plausible theories are not presented, well, conspiracy theories have become rife, no?
Well, yeah, there will be a lot of theories. That's one of the reasons why it's really critical for us to resolve this one way or the other. Again, I go back to those maintenance records. I think they're going to tell us what could have been happening on the airplane. And again, the sequence of failures will tell you, for example, were several electrical systems failing? Was there just one? You could test whether that would be consistent with a fire hypothesis, a depressurization hypothesis, or something else like that. But of course, there are people who will go with the conspiracy side, but we'll have to see what happens.
And again, we're going to start also with the regular maintenance records that were kept on the ground. Was the plane checked beforehand? And apparently, at least the reports that we're seeing so far is that everything checked out fine. But people will be going through that with the proverbial fine-tooth comb.
Sure, that's the part of any investigation. You'll go back and look at, you know, was there a maintenance history on this airplane? Were there parts that had been failing or were questionable? They will also go back and look at the crew's records. And we always go back and look at things like, did the crew sleep well the night before and things like that to see if there was a human factors cause.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest is John Hansman, Jr., professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. John's calling from Des Moines.
Yes, hello.
Hi, John.
Hi, thank you. It happens we're flying to Italy at the end of the week.
And are you nervous about that?
Sure, yeah. It's the last piece of news you want to read in the morning, Thursday morning before you depart. We'll still be going.
Still be going, will you make? I don't know. Is there anything you're going to do differently at all?
My wife and I are talking about it, but we are not going to be canceling our flight. There's other family involved. I have family over there, that sort of thing. The one issue, one thing my wife is happy about is we're flying on an American-based airline. One does read, I don't know whether to trust it, that the pilots on European airlines tend to be more cowboys. Somebody decided to fly into that storm area.
John,
I'll take your responses off the phone.
Okay, thanks. John Hansman, is there any truth to that?
No, I don't think so. I think that the professionalism, if you look at the statistics of the crews in most of the developed world, is excellent. And if you look at the accident rates, they're no different in Europe than they are in the U.S. There's some differences in procedures and style, but I wouldn't say that one country has cowboys and the other country doesn't. I would also note that from taking a trip standpoint, I wouldn't be worried about it. You know, by any measure, commercial aviation is the safest way to travel. And even with this accident, from a statistical standpoint, we're remarkably safe.
I think statistics would tell you that he's more in danger driving to the airport than he is on the flight from Des Moines to wherever, Washington or New York or Boston, and then on to Rome.
Yeah, absolutely. In the U.S., we lose about 40,000 people a year in car accidents. We actually have more people run over by trains than we have killed in aviation accidents. And a colleague actually of mine has calculated that if you were to take a flight once a day, day in and day out for, every day of the year, you'd have to live 35,000 years before statistically you'd be in a fatal aircraft accident.
Perry's on the line. Perry calling from Anchorage.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Perry.
Hi. Well, your speaker just pretty much said what I was going to say. I work as a professional pilot, and I'm also a general aviation pilot. And the most dangerous part of my flight is driving to the airport. And the statistics kind of bear that out.
So if you continue flying for the next 34,090 years, you could be in trouble.
Right. Well, I've got 10,000 hours of flight time. I've had a couple of engine failures, but even an engine failure is not really the end of the world.
All right, Perry. Thanks very much. Fly safe.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking about the flight of Air France 447, which vanished into the Atlantic on Monday. And questions about what happened and why, questions that may or may not be answered. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I forgot to ask you, John Hansman, about part of that earlier call. The plane flew into a thunderstorm. As you say, normally aircraft maneuver around thunderstorms. As I understand it, in that part of the world near the equator, that's not always possible.
Yeah, they were flying through. When you go north-south through the equator, you fly through what we call the intertropical convergence zone. And it's an area that tends to develop bands of thunderstorms, long bands of thunderstorms that run east-west. So it can often be difficult to pick your way through. And apparently from the satellite reports, in order to get around the line of thunderstorms, they would have had to go 300 or 400 miles out of their way. So it's likely they would pick the place of lowest precipitation and penetrate the line at that location.
Let's next go to Gabrielle. Gabrielle with us from Sacramento.
You know, this is such an important topic to me, and I'm glad you're asking the question, and I'm glad you're talking about the statistics, because until an airline has an incident like this based on incompetence and complete neglect, I will keep flying as much as possible for business and pleasure, because the statistics you just said are always in my favor as a passenger, and I don't think any airline would do something like this neglectful. It's devastating, but I would hate for anybody to not fly based on this one isolated incident.
So, Gabrielle, you might be more concerned by the crash of that flight up in Buffalo, which was judged to be due to the inexperience of the pilot on that particular aircraft.
Absolutely, and I have to say I have flown a lot of the smaller regional jets, and that's the only time I'm ever a little bit nervous. I know they have younger, less experienced pilots flying those, and you know, pilots go through a lot of kind of stress, I think, when they're first starting out, and those flights make me somewhat nervous, and it's usually a short hop, 45 minutes or so, but I have absolutely no problem being on the larger commercial jets, and I can't even imagine that this is based on incompetence by the airline. If anything, it's going to be probably maybe human error or something to do connected to the storms, but this will never affect the way I fly. I can't wait for my next trip all the time.
All right, Gabrielle, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. And let's go next to Susan. Susan with us from Augusta, Georgia.
Hi. Yes, this is Susan. I'm a terrified flyer to start with, but I'm leaving June 23rd to go to Spain. And one way I rationalize is that if I can make it through takeoff and landing, that no plane ever crashes over the Atlantic, and then that happens. So my big question has to do with turbulence, because I hear that word and it strikes fear in my heart. So I was wondering if he could address that. Do planes ever just fall out of the sky due to turbulence?
John Hansman?
Generally not. The cause of turbulence is basically just a change in the direction of the air. And normally the turbulence will be associated with things like storms. And we have radar on board the aircraft to identify the storms and normally try and fly around them. Occasionally you'll run into something called clear air turbulence, where often you get it at the edge of the jet stream. Again, normally, if there are other airplanes in front of you, they'll tell you in the turbulence where it is, and you'll have people sit down and put on their seatbelts. Normally, the risk from turbulence is actually people bouncing around the inside of the airplane if they're not strapped down. That's why you should wear your seatbelt. And occasionally, there have been cases where a flight attendant was hurt, literally bouncing off the ceiling. But the airplanes structurally are designed to take very severe turbulence, so you shouldn't have a problem of the airplane breaking due to the turbulence.
I know the wings are supposed to designed to flex in those situations. I just don't like to look at it.
They are designed to flex, and don't look at them, but they're fine.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Susan, have good luck on your flight, and have a great time in Spain.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Breyer. Why don't they float?
They do float. Airplanes, when they land, will float for a few hours.
I think we saw that in the landing in the Hudson River.
Absolutely. And then you have both life rafts and life jackets to get out there. Ditching in the deep ocean can actually be a little bit tricky just because, particularly if there's storms, the ocean surface can be much rougher than, for example, in that Hudson River landing. So that can be a little bit of a problem. But airplanes do float, but they don't float like boats because in order to make it like a real ship, it would be so heavy it would be hard to get it off the ground.
We'd be back to flying boats. And one more question. What about the black boxes? Why aren't there life preservers built around them?
It's hard to know that the life preserver wouldn't be damaged. So the way the black boxes are designed is they're designed to minimize the damage or to protect the recorders themselves. So they're in sort of protected boxes.
Shockproof.
And then what we do is we have these acoustic pingers to make them easy to locate. So they should have no problem being underwater. If this black box is recovered, it will be the deepest recovery ever. So normally we're not trying to recover them from such deep water.
John Hansman, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Sure.
John Hansman directs MIT's International Center for Air Transportation with us today from the campus in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tomorrow, Russell Peters, who's been doing stand-up for 20 years, stops by our studio to talk with us. We hope you'll join us for that. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.